Welcome to the Materials Universe podcast, where we will explore the materials world and how it shapes our lives. My name is Bailey Tibbett, and I will be your host this season. Please join me as I interview researchers from the Center for Dynamics and Control of Materials at the University of Texas at Austin. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Materials Universe podcast. I'm your host, Bailey Tibbett, and I'm here with our co-host,
Audrey Colgrove,
and our visiting professor, Dr. Stephanie Hurst. She's visiting from Northern Arizona University and is a professor in the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry. Hi, Dr. Hurst.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Pretty good, pretty good. We're hoping you enjoyed Austin a little bit. It's kind of cold.
It's been fabulous so far.
Awesome. So to start, could you tell us a little bit about your research?
Sure thing. So I always say that there's two kinds of chemists. Chemists who make stuff and chemists who measure stuff. I am definitely one of those chemists who make stuff. So my research interests are how materials can be used to modulate light. So I have an interest in using inorganic or organometallic complexes to modulate the properties of light, specifically looking at things such as photon generation, where you are taking light, usually from a laser beam, and then using a organometallic complex to generate new forms of that light. And this is an area that we call nonlinear optics.
What inspired you to study the specific area of chemistry?
That's a great question. So like I said, there are chemists who make stuff, and I am one of those. The way that you know that you're a chemist who makes stuff is when you have projects that gather throughout your laboratory and out your house, okay? Some of us, of course, may be going to things like crocheting and have 10 or 12 or 15 different projects, or some of other people, like myself, make a lot of things like props from video games and other areas. So I make a lot of things. So I always knew growing up that I wanted to be involved with making things. When I went to my graduate institution, which was Australian National University back in Canberra, Australia, I was offered two different possibilities. I could do measurements, looking at the photons that came out of different experiments, or I could be in the lab creating stuff. And it didn't take me long to find out that I liked making stuff. So that project has put me on a pathway where I still really, really love making stuff. There's nothing I enjoy more than taking undergraduate students and bringing them to my lab where they get that same joy of making things. The techniques that we use are relatively straightforward. We look for materials that are insensitive to environmental effects, things like moisture, things like exposure to oxygen. And that's important from an industrial perspective where you think about you've got this material and it needs to be robust. And so a lot of the materials that we work with use metals from the periodic table, from what we call the transition metals. Ruthenium is a particularly important one. We've also done a lot of work on gold chemistry as well. And so we take these metals, we add ligands or groups around the outside to change their properties. And then finally, we send them off to our laser spectroscopists, our wonderful friends who do the measurements, and they are the ones who, of course, send us back a giant table of data that we try and piece together. What exactly does this mean? When we say, what does it mean? What properties that we have changed? Maybe we changed a group from a short ligand group to a longer ligand group. Perhaps we took a pi conjugated pathway and we extended that, or we branched that. And in finding out what the effects are, we're immediately seeing a response from the light that is emitted, and that will guide us making future decisions. Should we look at a different metal? Should we look at a different ligand group? And so that's where I find that the chemists who make stuff really can work together with the chemists who measure stuff and advance disciplines in a collaborative way. And that's what's really exciting and what I really enjoy.
That's so cool. I loved listening to all of that.
Thank you.
I was going to ask, I guess, so if you're making kind of all of these insights and generating all this data, and when you interpret it, like what applications are you hoping to kind of use this for? Like what are you looking toward in terms of a problem maybe or a mystery that you want to uncover?
Thanks. No, that's a great question. Yeah, that's always an important question. Why are we doing this? It's lovely to have, of course, things that you explore just for the sake of exploring, but it's always good to keep in mind. So the field of nonlinear optics, or NLO usually as a shorthand, often has questions of what can we do with light. So I think being at a university, everybody is familiar with the humble laser pointer, right? And a laser pointer is really an amazing piece of technology. You know, of course, they're so cheap that your cat can have several of them if the cat is so inclined. But if you think about a green laser pointer, now, where you may not think of a green laser pointer is in a television remote. You may be aware, of course, that you don't see the light that comes from a remote because it's in the infrared. But if you use your camera phone, you can, in fact, see the infrared light. Now, inside a green laser pointer, the light gets emitted at around about 1,064 nanometers, deep inside the infrared and invisible to human eyes. But there's a tiny crystal inside every single green laser pointer that doubles the frequency. It takes two photons that have energy of 1,064 nanometers and emits that in the green frequency range right at 532. And so this is your classic green laser pointer. So the effect that's going on inside that tiny crystal is called frequency doubling. So that tiny crystal is doing something to that light. And that's what we're trying to do when we synthesize these compounds. There's a number of other properties, things what we call optical power limiting. So fortunately, there are good uses of laser pointer, illustrating a piece of scheme on a board or pointing out a star in the night sky. But unfortunately, there are people who use laser pointers and carelessly and maybe point them at aircraft, possibly, of course, damaging the vision of people who are piloting that aircraft. So what you can do is you can design materials called optical power limiters. These are materials that when they absorb that light, they undergo a process called bleaching. That is, they will change their properties on exposure to that laser beam specifically. And in doing so, you could imagine where perhaps a pilot or some other person who's working with lasers, maybe indoors, someone who's doing laser spectroscopy, is wearing a pair of these glasses where the laser light that comes in changes the property of the film inside the glass, causing them to be protected from that exposure to this light radiation. So there's a lot of possibilities, and most of them involve what can we do with light and change its properties using things on a molecular level.
I don't know. That's just so cool. I think, I mean, I know that that was a wonderful explanation, but I kept thinking in my head about my cat for some reason, because she likes to stand in front of the TV sensor when I'm trying to do things. And it used to not go through her. So I used to tell her that she just had a really, really small linear attenuation coefficient. But now I can tell her that she cannot overcome nonlinear optics, or she has overcome nonlinear optics.
So which part of that is related to the photon generation, if you wouldn't mind expanding on that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a series of nonlinear optical properties. Some of them are called photon doubling, where you double the energy, and you have a crystal. And what's going on inside that crystal is that you have atoms, and around each atom is a shell of electron density. And so what's really happening at a molecular level, right down at the core of it, is photons of some light are coming in. And at most of the time, what happens is they pass straight through the other side. This is what we might call linear optics. Linear optics in the sense of you're really just changing maybe the direction, like when a beam of light goes through water and it bends with its characteristic, what we call refractive index, or glass or vacuum perhaps. But if you're talking about high frequency light, or rather high energy light, I should be more careful, high energy light such as what you'd get from a laser, you start to introduce these additional coefficients. And that's the realm of what we call non-linear optics. Now, most of the time, we don't see these additional coefficients. For those who are mathematics in the audience, it's what we call a Taylor expansion. But that Taylor expansion means that not only is there a primary change, and that's the refractive index, but there's a secondary change, what we call beta, a tertiary change, what we call gamma, each of those being weaker and weaker again. And it's only when you have a very, very intense light source that you start to see these additional effects that otherwise would go unnoticed. And thankfully, we have lasers that do it for us these days.
Wow.
I see. So it's kind of like signal to background, where the laser is so strong that normally the frequencies or the energy would be in the background, but even though it's getting diluted every single time, it's still there. That's crazy.
Right. Yeah, we wouldn't otherwise notice. There's a lot of wonderful historical information that goes into the background of this. There's a famous Indian scientist who won a Nobel Prize, a chap called Chandrasekharan Raman, and he is, of course, the person that the Raman effect is named after.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. There you go.
For some reason, I always think of the noodles.
Exactly.
Even though I know it's not.
No, but Raman spectroscopy. We talk about it a lot in the MERSEC because it's, you know, used to investigate materials.
Yeah, and he did all his work back in the 1920s before lasers.
Wow.
And in fact, they needed an intense beam of light, which they didn't have access to. So he had a very clever idea, very, very brilliant chap. He took a telescope for looking at the night sky, and he turned that telescope around and pointed at the sun. And what happened is this intense and concentrated beam of light, which they didn't have, was focused on this sample. And only by amplifying that very weak background noise could they then start to see this Raman effect. And so, of course, you know, now these days we have lasers, but it's a wonderful piece of history talking us about how we can change the properties of light by being very clever about the materials that we select.
That's so fun. I took a bunch of astronomy classes in both my high school and undergraduate years, and one of the first lessons they do is point the telescope at the sun and show you how dangerous it is by burning a piece of paper.
Really?
That you can just, if you just point a telescope at the sun, put a piece of paper near the eyepiece, and it's like that old magnifying glass with ants.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, this might be too violent, but I have done this with ants and leaves.
No, but I love hearing kind of the origin of some of these really big scientific principles. It's really fascinating to investigate where a lot of our science comes from, because it's all very fundamental in the end.
I think a lot of it's really important because a lot of these stories are what students often remember.
Yes.
They will, of course, forget all the matrix algebra that they get taught, and that's okay. But if they remember the story about thinking about that deeper level, I think that's how professors can be more than just teachers. They can sort of be sources of perhaps inspiration to a certain degree.
Well, and that's a big philosophy in communication and science communication. Humans are going to connect via stories. Do you have any examples of that in your own teaching or work?
Oh, boy, so many. I mean, it's hard. My lecture style, I teach mostly inorganic chemistry at the junior and senior levels. I also teach nuclear chemistry just because I find it so fascinating. But I have to be very careful because, of course, I have a set curriculum that I need to teach. But inevitably, there will be some fascinating story, that will be of such interest that I can't. I tell students, wait. I got distracted. I'm going to tell you all about X, Y, and Z sort of thing. You know, for example, we're currently at UT Austin. What's the favorite drink? So I am told from the South. What's a favorite drink in the South?
Iced tea,
exactly. And so I tell my students to be like, there's this wonderful journal which talks about medical cases. And we have this person who I believe was in Georgia who came into the emergency room complaining of flank pain. And any doctor in the audience will know flank pain. That's kidney stones, of course, very agonizing. And they were reported that they weren't doing anything unusual. But of course, they did occasionally drink 12 to 15 cups of iced tea per day. Iced tea, of course, lovely drink, but full of what we call oxalate. And oxalate is this chelating group. It latches onto calcium and can generate these oxalate crystals, which, of course, is what we call kidney stones. So stories like that, I find my students will never, ever forget, no matter how many years have passed, about the stories that I tell them, which I think is important to remember, because science can often be dry, especially when you're trying to communicate it to people who are not necessarily primarily interested in science. But I think as communicators and as scientists, that it is part of our job description to be doing that and to try and do it as effectively as we can.
Yeah, I think
I hand it to the people who are very technical only sided, in that I feel like when you run things through stories or simple analogies and metaphors, even though I really also like doing that myself, I'll admit that like it's not the most precise thing in the world. But then I always kind of just counter them with like, you know, like significant figures in chemistry. Like, how precise do we have to be before this is kind of too precise? Like, it's lost its own purpose. And so I love classes like yours where you're telling science through stories, because it's like you said, you remember it better. And not only do you remember it better, you develop this kind of weird, insightful intuition that just kind of like naturally happens, where like you could probably ask them like, oh, how would this change if it was like this? And they would probably be able to answer it off the top of their heads, or at least give a very good educated guess, even though you don't teach them any of the principles, which I always think is really cool.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, just looking at a periodic table, you know, you look at, say, one element, maybe chromium or something like that, and then you look underneath that and you find molybdenum. And you're like, maybe that has similar properties. And the answer is, in fact, it does have similar properties. And then you look underneath molybdenum, you find tungsten. And so, of course, you see, hey, maybe this has similar properties. And, of course, you can then start to expand that. You can start to sort of work on that. And it becomes, like you say, sort of a chemical intuition. And I think that's a really powerful thing, because it's saying that there is something deep in the corners of the recesses of your mind that is guiding you, leading you, okay, that maybe we don't always engage with on a conscious level, but our exposure and our experience guides us to these new and novel insights that we maybe wouldn't otherwise have.
Yeah, I think the other reason why I also really agree with like thinking about things as an intuitive skill is that it's still a skill, like at its base. I feel like a lot of the time in STEM education, there's very much this feeling of like, oh, I am just not suited toward this, or I cannot do this thing because I was not into Legos when I was a kid, or whatever, like people say. But I think it's definitely been changing, and it's been really important to, you know, kind of connect people with stories so that they feel like it is something that they can enter into with like no barriers to entry, because it really is just developing a skill over and over and over again, or at least almost like opening your mind to the possibility of something.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think of my background. So I'm from Australia. I grew up on a farm. And for the first 12, 15 years of my life, I went to school, I came home to the farm and chased cattle all day. And that was really fun. But there was never a time where people said, no, you can't do this. And I think it's where you encourage, be like, go ahead, do this, try it, see if you like it. And I think that's a matter of really helping people develop, is never saying no to them, in the sense of you can guide them, but I think you really have to be careful not to hold them back. Okay, they will find out what they like, they will find out their skills, but if you say no to them, that's where it can be quite a challenge to then convince them to say maybe yes.
This is one of my biggest educational philosophies, because a large part of my role is training our graduate students to facilitate educational experiences with young students. And one of the things I always teach them is that it's better to yes and a wrong answer than it is to say no and correct them. And stop me if I've told this on the podcast before. I'm not sure if I have. I worked on it was a group that was bringing eclipse education to Austin for our big eclipse. And I was talking to a young woman about how she can use a telescope to look at the eclipse with her students. And she told me what she thought an eclipse was, like what she thought the physics of it and the, you know, everything. And she was absolutely wrong. She had no clue what was going on, but she didn't need to. She was her first time talking about an eclipse. And before I could try and talk to her about it, one of our local astronomers stepped in and went, no, you're wrong. And here's exactly why you're wrong. And the energy left her. And I kind of had to go in and do some damage control and be like, oh, let's talk about why it's fun and why it's interesting. But that is so important to be able to continue the kind of energy and interest of students.
No, absolutely. I think from, as someone who does terrible, terrible improv comedy, yes and is a really key feature of that, because it doesn't matter what the other party is bringing to the table. You are going to take that, and it is the best idea you've ever had, that anyone has ever had. trick for those people out there. Whenever somebody in the question, in the audience asks a question, it is a great question.
Yeah.
Okay. No matter what the question was, it's a great question. So yes, using that energy to give that yes and to make the people, person feel, you know, wow, I learned something new and I corrected an old misperception. Mm-hmm. I think that's really important. And it's a skill. You're not going to always get it right on the first time. Like any skill, it's going to take time to remember yes and.
Yeah, I think it's definitely like a fundamental part of being in terms of like being adverse to failure. I hate failing. You know, like they say that like, oh, if your kid falls on the ground or if you see like a young child who falls on the ground and you like really freak out and you like, you're like, oh my gosh, how could you fall or whatever, they'll freak out with you, right? But if you like don't necessarily acknowledge it as a failure, it's just like, are you okay, like let's get up and walk again, then it's like much more like that yes and kind of energy. And so I've always, I mean, I complain sometimes about academia as a whole on this podcast, but I have, one of the things I have definitely noticed as a graduate student, at least, is that we're very focused on never failing, which is kind of crazy to me because the whole point of experimentation, I think, is to fail. And so it's just like, I feel like we're so focused on publishing and stuff and getting good results, which are all great and fine. And I think that they have real value in them. But sometimes I feel like there are some graduate students who could definitely use like a, it's okay to fail, this is fine. So I guess I wanted to ask you, like, and your group, have there been any large failures that you've been, you know, you had to wrangle up all of the yes and energy you can and just kind of move forward?
No, that's fantastic. Absolutely. Those happen so, so often. I think that we are often misled in how easy or straightforward things can be, in the sense of, I can think from my own group that I have had several projects making thin films, and the materials and the procedures all suggested that this should be a cakewalk. Everything should go swimmingly. Audience note, things do not go swimmingly. And at that time, you know, it was an opportunity there, even though we didn't get what we wanted, we could not make the thin films give the properties that we wanted, we still found a way to actually advance. So my graduate student, Maddie, she is fantastic, okay? But she could not get these thin films to work. And she spent many, many hours studying these films using electron microscopy, and it turned out that electron microscopy was her interest. That was what she found exciting. Not making the stuff, apparently that falls back to me, but analyzing. And so she has gone on. She's currently on a DOE award at Sandia. She's got access to some of the most powerful microscopes on the planet. And so coming out of that, what seemed at a time a failure, but then discovering that there was something that you could take away from that was really encouraging in the end. In the short term, more of a challenge.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is definitely all hindsight. I remember starting my PhD and being like, wow, I'm just never going to get anything done. And now I'm like telling the younger students, like, don't worry about it. You're on track. Like all of that stuff. I think it's just, I guess it's the curse, but also blessing of time passing.
Yes, yes. Progression is an important skill. You know, there's an old phrase that my mum would always tell me, and it sounds very strange to American ears, I'm sure. It's like, it's not sheep stations. Sheep stations back home are very big operations, thousands and thousands of sheep, hundreds of thousands of acres. That's a real problem. That your experiment didn't work today, that's not sheep stations. That's a little bit further down the carding order, and that's okay.
I love that that's a kind of a universal mentality. When I worked in the Children's Museum, there was something, it was a mantra we'd say to ourselves. We'd say, there's no such thing as an emergency at the Children's Museum. I mean, and to be fair, there are. But in general, if it wasn't a child going missing, it wasn't an emergency. And we kind of had to remind ourselves and use that to push us forward.
Yeah, I kind of think of this in like, in terms of almost like the Higgs boson field, in a sense, where like there's this invisible field that gives things meaning. And granted, we can't control it, this one at least, but we can control our own perspective and like our own relations and change how different experiences and objects kind of relate to each other within this field. Even though if you asked me to draw it for you, I can't draw, so it wouldn't really happen. But I really like that kind of idea of like, you know, like if I continue on as if this is not an emergency, I'm not invalidating the fact that it's very stressful and very emergent. But I am just trying to find a way to move forward and kind of assign more of an actionable meaning, which I think is really cool.
Yeah. No, grad students are under a lot of stress, as are professors. I don't think there's any place that is not under stress. I think it's how you find a healthy way to deal with that stress that's really important, that the action of dealing with it is half the battle as well. It's why, you know, to a degree, it's important to find a community that you can reach out to. The worst graduate student is an isolated graduate student, I find, that if there is a graduate student out there who's suffering or struggling or having a hard time, you've got to find the peers who can help you get through it, okay? It's really, really tough. Graduate school is a real challenge. Otherwise, everybody would be doing it. But at the same time, reach out to your cohort, talk with your people who care about you, and that's going to be half the battle right there, sort of thing. Sometimes there are really emergencies, but a lot of the time it's bigger in our mind than what it actually is.
Well, and that's a big conversation in the MRSEC, and I'm sure at other NSF centers as well, is being a graduate student can be so isolating. And, you know, a lot of our work is about funding this research, but then, you know, there's the human side of it, making sure that the people in it are still good to continue doing that research. And so we have to prioritize some of the community building so that y'all can prioritize the research.
Yes. Sometimes I do feel like it's pulling teeth a little bit, or like forcing a little kid to eat their vegetables. You're like, I promise this is an important presentation.
You're going to come, you're going to listen to this presentation, you're going to have a slice of pizza, and you're going to have a blast, and you're going to make a friend.
That's a great way to approach it. That's great.
You mentioned dealing with like stress and stuff, and then I remember earlier in the podcast, you had mentioned building things. Can you tell us a little bit about your hobbies? We love asking professors what their stress
other areas of your life where you like making things.
Oh, good heavens. I have so many projects at home. So I am a huge sort of video game kind of, you know, anime kind of nerd.
Oh, you're you're preaching to the choir.
Okay.
At least the two of us. Maybe not the audience.
That's
we can
okay.
Talk to us about
that's
it.
Okay.
They'll learn
new
things.
At least
our studio person.
Yeah. So there's a lot of props that I'll make from various, you know, games. So I'm a big fan of the Fire Emblem series.
Oh, yeah.
You know, represent three houses out there. And so a lot of the props will come from that. A lot of, say, for example, you know, K-pop Demon Hunters.
Oh.
So I've made a lot of the weapons and the other accessories that they have. And so a lot of that is stuff that I'll give away to my friends. I have one friend who's a huge fan of the Lord of the Rings, as am I. So I have this Gandalf staff that lights up. Sort of thing. So yeah, it's a fun thing to do when I'm not at work because it still scratches that itch of like wanting to make stuff. But at the end, instead of like a jar of powdery solid, you have this amazing, incredible sword that you can hand to a friend and say, I made it for you. This is my gift of time. That's how I appreciate people. I guess I do things for them. So
that maker itch is really a It's really interesting to see how it kind of comes out in different ways. So we have a maker studio in house at the Indiana School of Engineering, and I'm from the museum industry, and so I've talked to a lot of those people, and it's really fascinating. And I've always wondered why I didn't go into it, and then I realize on some end I am making stuff because I'm working with the kids and things, but then I go home and it's just still there, and so I make a loaf of bread or I do a crochet project just because there's still something in me that maybe is tired of work but really wants to continue. You doing something with my hands or my brain. And I love feeding that. Are there any other ways you feed your kind of maker itch? It's okay.
I mean, a lot of it is just getting to work, to do it both for work and, of course, at home. Yeah. I think that's the major things. The rest of the time, there's not a whole lot of time available.
Yeah.
But I think it also, like you say, it feeds into what I teach my students. Yeah. I love learning new things, whether it's like, oh, hey, I can get this perfect wood grain finish on this thing. Or it's like, hey, let me tell you this cool story. You know, it's just like, Professor Hurst, what are you doing in the forensics literature so much? It's not healthy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's what I find is just the opportunities to like find new things, teach new skills, and discover stuff is really great.
Awesome.
Well, so to wrap up, we like asking all of our guests the same question. And so we're curious if there are any emerging materials or smaller fields in kind of the realm of your work and also material science at large that you find really exciting for the next decade of research.
Oh, wow. Where to begin?
Yeah.
That's such a cool question. Thank you so much. I think there's a lot of interest in fundamental materials science. Mm-hmm. I am excited about the use of large language models, particularly mm-hmm. in materials research, to help direct us. I don't think it's a panacea in the sense of we've had tremendous success using large language models, or more generally AI, mm-hmm. to drive protein or understanding of protein structure. You know, there's a large number of models that will predict the folding of proteins. We don't yet have that for materials science. But how those models learn is when they have a large amount of data to be fed to them. Mm-hmm. We're still in that process where we are discovering materials, feeding it to these large AI type systems, and seeing if the answers make sense, seeing if we can work collaboratively and say, try this material or try this modification of this material. We're not there yet in terms of making predictions, I don't feel, but it's going to be a very exciting next 10 to 15 years to find out.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the Materials
Universe. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all for today's episode of the Materials Universe podcast. Thank you for listening to our interesting conversations with inspiring guests from different fields of science and engineering. We hope you enjoyed learning something new. Please leave us a review and share this podcast with friends. You can follow us on social media at TexasCDCM on Instagram and X. Thank you to the National Science Foundation and the University of Texas at Austin, and an additional thank you to the Late's Audio Studio crew for their help with the production of this podcast.